From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
In federal court yesterday, the daughter of a Halliburton truck driver who was killed in Iraq brought a lawsuit alleging wrongful death. This is the first of numerous lawsuits against the company.
The family of a Halliburton truck driver killed in Iraq sues the company for his death. We'll speak with investigative journalist Prothap Chatterjee. Then on Easter Sunday at the Baghdad airport, an employee of Halliburton's subsidiary, KBR, alleges he was beaten by a group of his co-workers. We'll talk with his father.
My son Ron was brutally attacked by fellow Americans in Baghdad and is presently in the hospital in Baghdad. And I believe what I hear lately is that he is on his way to Germany for treatment there, and we hope that everything's fine.
And one of America's best-known lawyers has died. Johnny Cochran passed away yesterday. We'll get reaction from a lawyer who worked with him for 25 years. All that and more coming up as we broadcast live from Houston, Texas. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The newly formed Iraqi National Assembly has been thrown into chaos as the parliament failed again to form a coalition government. Both interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi and interim President Ghazi Yawar stormed out of Tuesday's session before it ended. The session was being broadcast on national TV in Iraq, but the acting Speaker of the Parliament ordered the television feed to be cut off after 20 minutes. Journalists in attendance were kicked out. The Green Zone, where the session takes place, also came under mortar attack on Tuesday. The lawmakers will meet on Sunday with hopes they can move forward. The Shiites, Kurds, and Sunnis can't decide on who should serve as Speaker of the Parliament or how to fill certain cabinet positions, especially the oil ministry. There's a released Pentagon memo that confirms the top U.S. commander in Iraq personally authorized the use of prisoner interrogation tactics harsher than those allowed by the Army. According to a memo from September 2003, Army Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez approved the use of guard dogs to scare detainees in an effort to exploit what Sanchez described as, quote, Arab fear of dogs. Sanchez also permitted interrogators to put prisoners in potentially painful bodily positions to try to force them to talk. The memo was obtained by the American Civil Liberties Union. The ACLU says the Pentagon initially refused to release the memo on national security grounds. The group accused the Bush administration of not releasing the memo in order to, quote, protect itself from embarrassment. Sanchez was the top commander in Iraq at the time. U.S. soldiers abused Iraqi detainees at Abu Ghraib. This news from Indonesia. Rescue workers continue to search for survivors from Monday's large underwater earthquake. Some 1,000 people are presumed dead. The main town on the Indonesian island of Nias has been reduced mostly to rubble. And the Pope is now being fed through a nasal tube. This comes a month after doctors inserted a tube in his throat to help him breathe. The Pope made a brief appearance earlier today. He made the sign of the cross with his hand, but was unable to speak. This year marks the first time during his papacy that he was unable to celebrate Easter Mass. The family of Terry Schiavo won a surprise court decision late last night. A federal appeals court in Georgia agreed to consider a petition by her parents for a new hearing on whether to reconnect their severely brain-damaged daughter's feeding tube. It's been nearly 2 weeks since a state court ordered Schiavo's feeding tube removed. Meanwhile, the Reverend Jesse Jackson joined with Schiavo's family Tuesday, calling for her life to be saved. He described the case as, quote, one of the most profound moral and ethical issues of our time.
Food or water for 12 days, there are vital signs. She is being starved to death. She has been dehydrated to death. And that's inhumane. It's immoral and it is unnecessary. there's no rational reason for this to happen.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson. At the United Nations, Secretary General Kofi Annan has been cleared of wrongdoing over an Iraq oil deal involving his son. Questions have been raised whether Kofi Annan had helped a company win contracts in Iraq at a time the company employed his son, Kodjo. The UN panel says it still has significant questions of Kodjo's dealings, but the panel could not find evidence linking Kofi Annan to the deal. The Secretary General says he viewed the panel's finding as an exoneration. When asked if he would step down, Annan said, quote, hell no. U.S. Senator Norm Coleman, however, again called for Annan's resignation. Coleman said the incident highlights Annan's lack of leadership and accountability. The Financial Times is reporting the Bush administration is drawing up a secret watch list of 25 countries where the U.S. might decide to intervene because it views the nations as unstable. The list will be compiled by the National Intelligence Council. Last year, the Bush administration set up a new office within the State Department to deal solely with reconstruction and stabilization of other countries. That office is headed by Carlos Pascual, the former U.S. ambassador to the Ukraine. Human Rights Watch announced Tuesday it's uncovered evidence that a Yemeni man being detained at Guantanamo Bay was originally picked up in Egypt 3 years ago during a business trip. The man, who is an intelligence colonel in the Yemeni government, disappeared during his trip to Egypt and wasn't heard from for 19 months. He believes he was kidnapped by Egyptian officers who then turned him over to the United States. He was taken to a prison in Afghanistan and later to Guantanamo Bay. Human Rights Watch says it's the first known example of reverse rendition, where a wanted person is seized in a foreign country far from any battlefield, then handed over to the U.S. for interrogation. In a related story, the New York Times has obtained flight records of the plane that the U.S. likely used to secretly fly Maher Arar to Syria 3 years ago. Arar is the Syrian-born Canadian citizen who was detained by U.S. officials at JFK Airport in 2002 during a stopover. He was jailed and then shipped to Syria, where he was tortured. Charges were never filed against him. He's now suing the U.S. government. The Justice Department is trying to have the case dismissed on national security grounds. And in business news, a federal judge Tuesday approved a $16 million criminal fine against Riggs Bank. The bank was fined for failing to report suspicious transactions involving foreigners, including former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. Riggs helped Pinochet hide millions of dollars in secret accounts. U.S. District Judge Ricardo Urbina described the bank as a, quote, greedy corporate henchman of dictators and their corrupt regimes. In Santa Cruz, California, the city's longtime pirate radio station, Free Radio Santa Cruz, is celebrating 10 years on the air today. It's one of the longest-running non-licensed radio stations in the country. Meanwhile, in Tennessee, media activists are gathering this weekend to help launch Radio Free Nashville. The community radio station recently received a low-power license from the FCC. The so-called barn raising is being organized by the Prometheus Radio Project. And one of the country's best-known attorneys, Johnny Cochran, has died at the age of 67. Past clients of Cochran's include police brutality victim Abner Louima, Geronimo Gijaga Pratt of the Black Panther Party, rapper Tupac Shakur, and O.J. Simpson. We'll have more on Johnny Cochran later in the program. And essayist and social critic Harold Cruz has also died at the age of 89. He was best known for his 1967 book, The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual. He spent nearly two decades teaching at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, where he helped found the school's Center for Afro-American and African Studies department. He once taught black history at Amira Baraka's Black Arts Repertory Theater and School in Harlem.
Some people say that the
Take a Stand by Voices of East Harlem here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we broadcast from Houston, Texas, as we continue our Unembed the Media tour around the country. Tonight we'll be in Washington, D.C., celebrating Pacifica Station WPFW. But here in Texas, we talk about a lawsuit. The mother and daughter of an American truck driver killed in Iraq filed a federal lawsuit yesterday against Halliburton, based here in Texas, the primary contractor providing logistical support to the military in Iraq. The two women are seeking redress for the wrongful death of Tony Johnson, a truck driver from Riverside, California, who was killed almost 1 year ago near Baghdad International Airport. This is the first of what are expected to be several lawsuits by truck drivers and their families against the Houston-based company. Johnson was one of 19 truck drivers carrying fuel for the United States military from Camp Anaconda to the airport. The convoy drove straight into a major gun battle on April 9, 2004, on what's become the world's most dangerous highway. 2 hours later, six drivers had died, one was kidnapped, one had disappeared. Only 11 made it to their destination alive that day, the first anniversary of the United States' defeat of Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq. We're joined today on the phone by Prothap Chatterjee, executive director of CorpWatch.org and author of the book Iraq, Inc., A Profitable Occupation. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Prothap.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
Can you explain what this lawsuit is all about?
Well, the lawsuit, which was filed by a firm in Orange County, California, is basically stating that the company intentionally placed these workers in harm's way. In fact, it goes further than that. It says that they were a decoy to ensure that if there was an attack, one of two convoys carrying fuel would be able to make it through. And what's most bizarre about this is that the second convoy made it through, whereas the Hamill convoy, this convoy is often called the Hamill convoy because Thomas Hamill was the leader of the convoy, and listeners may recall that he was kidnapped very dramatically and shown on video and then escaped 3 weeks later and wrote a book about his exploits. Well, almost every other driver who made it through and the seven families that were killed are not happy with Halliburton. And one of the reasons they're not happy is the fact that they were sent on this trip without adequate preparation. In fact, many of them, most of them, had not traveled this route and weren't really sure exactly where they were going. And they were traveling, they were driving unarmed military vehicles as opposed to civilian trucks. And then finally, the military didn't provide them with adequate protection. Normally, the military is supposed to provide at least one soldier per two trucks, and they only had six out of a minimum 10 that should have been supplied. Well, And what's most ironic is once they got to the Baghdad International Airport where they're delivering the fuel, the people at the airport said, we don't even need this fuel. And it's symptomatic of either the chaos in Iraq or, you know, the bureaucratic and incompetence bungling of a lot of the logistical support that Halliburton's doing. And you have to wonder how much of each, how much it's intentional and badly managed, or how much of it is chaos. The lawsuit is alleging that this is deliberate, and in fact, because the Halliburton managers knew that there was a very good chance that the soldiers would be, that the truck drivers might get killed, that this they needed to set two convoys in two different directions to double their chances of making it through. And so what's happened now is that many of the families are bringing this lawsuit against Halliburton. And in fact, most of the people on the convoy expect to join this lawsuit in the next 2 weeks. The actual incident, as you said, happened on April 9th, which is probably the most dangerous day to travel in Iraq to date. And I was actually there in Iraq that day. And I was staying at the Al Fanar Hotel right across from a Halliburton employee stay in Baghdad. And every half hour, a tank would go out and say, do not travel this day. The military has a system of classifying the danger level on the roads. Green means you can go, amber means be cautious, you know, red means it's very dangerous, and black means nobody should travel at all. Well, all the roads were black, and they were not supposed to leave the Camp Anaconda, which is where they were based near Balad. Now, here's the problem, is that a soldier, in fact, not that particular day, a previous convoy, or perhaps even two convoys, I think, had gone out on that road and being shot at. In fact, it lost several trucks and came back. So you'd think that at some point the military would say, we got to stop taking chances, but that's not what happened. Except for the fact, and this is, you know, again, this is definitely the bungling side of things, a soldier actually sent out a message saying, road's very dangerous, advise, you know, do not travel, or something to that effect. But by mistake, he sent the email to himself instead of the truck driver, so it never made it to them. So perhaps that was the mistake that was made. The ultimate result is that they ran into this two-hour gun battle, out of the 19 men, as you said, you know, six have died, one's disappeared, and is almost certainly dead.
Prothap Chatterjee, the difference between what the drivers say happened on that day and what Halliburton says happened in the U.S. military.
Well, Halliburton says that they take all possible precautions and they train the drivers. And in fact, post that incident, they've doubled their precautions. They stopped sending out convoys and that sort of thing. Now, here's the crucial difference, I think, also, and if you look at it as bungling and chaos and things like that, is that the company, in recruiting the drivers, and this is what they say, were never informed of what would happen. And in fact, they were informed of exactly the opposite. They were told if there was any danger, they could leave at any time. And that, they discovered, was not true. So truck drivers are lured. Most of these people, you know, they're from Mississippi. In fact, one of the truck drivers was from Mississippi, and he's the one who's disappeared, you know, from North Carolina, from Alabama, all over the country. They're lured by this promise of $100,000. And this is where Kim Johnson, the ex-wife of Tony Johnson, the driver who was killed, and April Johnson is bringing the lawsuit, really want the public to know that these jobs are dangerous and that, in fact, you get paid badly, you live in bad conditions, and they won't protect you. And so to them, even more than getting compensation is the fact that they feel like the company has completely misled the soldiers from day one. I mean, they're not even hired by Halliburton. They're hired by a Cayman Islands subsidiary called the Service Employees International. And once they get there, their salary is, and this is getting to maybe not the detail of the lawsuit, but the salary is actually $16 an hour. It is not $100,000 a year. You've got to work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. And if you don't stay your full year, it's not even tax-free. So what the family is saying, Tony Johnson's daughter, April Johnson, and her mom, is that the company has completely misled these drivers in the jobs that they're doing.
Can you talk about the military's role in this? For example, in a piece you write, Driving into Danger, you say that it's clear some of the blame does lie with the military. And you talk an email that was, well, kind of sent, but to the wrong person.
That's correct, Amy. Email was sent by a soldier who was supposed to be in charge of telling them about risk. And I think the original email, which I haven't seen, we know just the circumstances of it, was about the fact that other convoys had been attacked on the same road. So he was supposed to have sent it directly to the drivers, and they have these Qualcomm units in the trucks, and so they would have been able to pick up something like that. However, by mistake, he sent it himself, and the mistake was not discovered. So a crucial piece of information was missing. Now, the Army has actually done a very extensive report on this, because this is literally the most dangerous day for contractors to date. It's rare that so many people are killed, you know, on the same day. And so a report was done by the person who was in charge of this convoy, at least the military protection of the convoy, and his name is Colonel Bunch. And so he's produced a 280-page report, and this is, you know, obviously a secret report, but more than being, it's been shared with the families themselves, like the Johnsons. But what's missing is a lot of information that Halliburton's blacked out. Halliburton said, you cannot publish this information. And in fact, what Colonel Bunch says specifically, he's with the 172 Corps Support Group, He says, if information was properly sent to subordinate units, actions could have been taken to potentially minimize the impact of hostile engagement, which, you know, is military speak for, you know, they screwed up.
We're talking to investigative reporter Prothap Chatterjee. He's executive director of CorpWatch.org, has just written the piece Driving into Danger about lawsuit brought by survivors of those in Iraq working for Halliburton. We're going to come back with Prothap Chatterjee in a minute, and we'll also be speaking with the father of a man who works for KBR, a Halliburton subsidiary. That's Kellogg Brown and Root. And we're going to be talking about the situation his son is in. He says he was gang beaten by other employees of KBR. Stay with us. Home to Houston by Steve Earle, where we are right now, Houston, Texas. As we continue to talk about the lawsuit against Halliburton, which is based here in Houston, we're talking with investigative reporter Prothap Chatterjee about a lawsuit that has just been brought against Halliburton. Prothap, this is not the first lawsuit brought by these contractors in Iraq. Can you talk about Blackwater and the famous situation in Fallujah that led to the deaths of four Blackwater workers and how it compares to this lawsuit?
Well, Amy, the Blackwater employees were guarding a food convoy, we understand, which was subcontracted to a company in Kuwait called Regency, which is then subcontracted to a company in Germany called ESS, which was then subcontracted to Halliburton. So essentially, they were actually working for Halliburton also. And the difference is these men were actually supposed to be in danger. That was their job. And, in fact, they signed a waiver saying you cannot sue Halliburton if get shot, permanently maimed, killed by fire, munitions, falling aircraft, helicopter, sniper fire, landmines, artillery fire, rocket propelled grenade, truck or car bomb, poisoning, civil uprising, terrorist activity, hand-to-hand combat, etc. So they've specifically, unlike the Halliburton employees, being told that they might get killed, and in fact their job, they cannot sue for that. But what the lawyer, Dan Callahan, who's also right here in California, is alleging is that the company took reckless risks with the lives of their employees and that they didn't give them proper protection, sent them in again into a place where they should not have gone. And so they're similar cases, but they're different contracts. And of course, the fallback of both the companies is going to be the Defense-Based Compensation Act, which is a little like workman's comp, and basically say, well, there's an amount of money that you can be paid, and since in the Blackwater case they're not allowed to sue, and the Halliburton case, the contract actually says, you know, they're supposed to enter arbitration, that in fact that there is the worry that this might be tossed out of court. The key thing that both lawyers are going to try and argue, Ramon Lopez in the case of the Halliburton truck drivers and Dan Callan in case of the families of Blackwater employees, is that, you know, these companies took unnecessary risks. And in fact, voided their contract, and therefore this should be admitted into court. The contract doesn't allow them to do just about anything. So that's sort of the key difference. And hopefully, actually, one of the interesting things, I think, in this story we published is actually a contrast with a second story that we're running about how the managers were living it up in the Hilton in Kuwait, in these sort of luxury resorts with swimming pools and taking million-dollar bribes. And this is, I think, the dual lives of people at Halliburton is, on the one hand, truck drivers and security people are out there in the forefront, and they risk their lives, and not even for that much money. On the other hand, the Halliburton people themselves, the managers, the senior managers, are doing very nicely out of this whole thing. Thank you very much.
We're talking to Prothap Chatterjee. Where do you think the current lawsuit against Halliburton will go? What is the process now that has been filed?
Well, the process of it is this is the first lawsuit, and they expect at least a dozen or so other lawsuits to be filed in the next couple of weeks before the first anniversary of the actual incident, which is April 9th. And the reason for that is in some jurisdictions, at least, there's a statute of limitations. And the way if you have a whole group of lawsuits, it often behooves the judge to consolidate them with a lot of these kinds of cases and look at them together. And then the thing that happens automatically is if it's admitted to court, which I believe it will be, it allows them to go into discovery. So that means the lawyers can get hold of internal documents that show what happened on that particular day. And that should be very, very interesting. It's a little like, the parallel lawsuit is sort of, I guess the ACLU on suing the Rumsfeld and people and finding all these internal documents about what they were doing, the latest being today a memo by General Sanchez saying you can torture the prisoners, use stress positions. So these are the kinds of documents they're going to be looking for. Now, the judge could say, sorry, the contract's in order, and this is not enough to merit going forward, and dismiss it, but then you can go to an appeals court. So it could take a while.
Prothap Chatterjee, investigative reporter with CorpWatch.org. Prothap, I'd like you to stay on the line as we turn now to our next story, because we'd like to get comment from you, being that you are really one of the leading reporters in this country looking at military and civilian contractors now in Iraq. Well, the father of an employee of Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root in Iraq is alleging that his son was gang-beaten by a group of fellow employees at the Baghdad airport, where he works as a security coordinator for KBR. Yesterday, the father of Ron Chavez, who is from right here in Houston, Texas, sent a letter to the U.S. Justice Department. It reads, "My son, Ronald Lee Chavez, an employee of Halliburton in Iraq, was severely beaten by peer Halliburton employees. These employees are known in Iraq as the Leesville, Louisiana Redneck Mafia. Ronald was medevaced to Camp Anaconda, where he's in a military hospital and remains there." The letter goes on to say, "According to my daughter-in-law, Patty, Ronald is to be transferred to a military hospital in Germany because of atrial fibrillation to his heart due to the severe beating. What I understand," writes the father, "Halliburton has advised Patty that Ronald needs a passport to get medical treatment at the military hospital in Germany. While Ronald was in Albuquerque on R&R, he advised me his boss did not like him because Ronald is Hispanic, and that the Redneck Mafia ran the operation for Halliburton at Baghdad Airport. Ronald further advised me that he had reported by memorandum to higher authority within the Halliburton chain of command the vulnerabilities at Baghdad Airport regarding to terrorist attacks. Ronald further stated that higher authority was upset at his recommendations. According to Patty," his father continues to write, "Halliburton advised her that they had sent three of the Redneck Mafia members back to the USA and that Halliburton was not going to file criminal charges against them. They further advised that the U.S. government did not have jurisdiction in Iraq and they were not going to turn the three Redneck Mafia members over to Iraqi law enforcement." The letter goes on to say, according to Patty, Ronald advised her that he received a radio transmission while he was in his quarters at Baghdad Airport, advising him that an American needed assistance at certain location. Ronald responded with no assigned backup. He entered a building where redneck mafia members were located and appeared to be intoxicated. Moments later, Ronald was attacked by 8 members of the redneck mafia and beaten while the others watched. One of the mafia members hit Ronald on the head with a radio, causing Ronald to bleed and go down to the ground. While on the ground and incapacitated, members of the redneck mafia continued to kick and hit Ronald while he was helpless on the ground. Ronald could not defend himself. And the letter concludes, it is unclear who gave the order to dispatch Ronald to the location and or who called for medical assistance. According to Patty, his wife, Ronald is waiting for a military aircraft to transfer him to Germany for treatment. Ronald is presently in ICU in serious condition. That's the letter written to the U.S. Justice Department yesterday by Eli Chavez, the father of Ron Chavez. His father says he plans to file a criminal complaint against anyone involved in his son's beating. Eli Chavez joins us now here in our studio in Houston, Texas. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It is good to have you with us.
So, it's good to be here.
Give us the chronology of events.
Well, I received a telephone call on the day after Easter, which would be Monday, I believe, and it was Patty on the line, and she advised me that that Ronnie had been beaten by fellow Americans, and I quickly disregarded the beating, but why from fellow Americans, and I became very angry at the time, and I decided that it's time to take the bull by the horn and be upfront with what is happening to my son. My son was beaten brutally and was unnecessary by these thugs that beat him. And it's time for the United States government, and I have great faith in our judicial system that it will do something about this. Has to be followed up by the Department of Justice, and I believe that they will do something about it. If not, we are in trouble in our country.
What is KBR saying to you right now?
I haven't talked to KBR at all. It's all been through Patty. Patty has had communication with them at all times.
Well, we did call KBR and ask them for response. We asked them to join us on the program. After all, we are here in Houston, Texas. They responded, and this is a letter from Jennifer Dellinger. And I have to say, although they made clear that we are talking to Kellogg Brown and Root, the subsidiary of Halliburton, it was interesting that Jennifer Dellinger's email is Jennifer Dellinger at Halliburton. But she responded, as we previously stated, KBR is currently investigating the situation and cannot provide further details at this time.
Well, apparently they are, because they did send 3 of those people back to the United States without any prosecution or any criminal complaints filed against them.
So explain who these people are. I mean, you've seen your son within the time he's been in Iraq. He's come back.
Yes, he was an R&R. And I'm from Albuquerque, not from Houston.
Right. But your son is here, living here. Can you talk about who this, what he calls the redneck mafia, is?
Well, he explained to me at that time that that his boss didn't seem to like Hispanics, or he did not like a memorandum that he had written about the vulnerabilities at the Iraqi Baghdad airport. And all he wanted to do was protect Americans and protect the people there. And it seemed like it backfired on him, and he became isolated by it was a political thing, what he described to me. He became isolated by the other employees and his boss.
And this group of people that beat him, who are they?
What I understand and what Patty advised me, that these people were from Leesville, Louisiana, and Halliburton recruits heavily in that area. And these are the people that they employed and sent to Iraq.
And had he had dealings with them before?
Not that I'm aware of, and I don't know if he had or not.
Was he afraid of them?
Well, he didn't say anything about being afraid. Ronnie's very—he's pretty much a person that's not afraid of anything.
I wanted to look at these two email that your son Ron sent to you. The first, December 27th, 2004. The second, January 11th, 2005, just a few months ago. Actually, maybe you could read the email that Ron wrote to you in late December.
Waiting on a response from the company guys. I might take it to Basra. A lot better situation down there. He was trying to get transferred to the southern Iraq rather than being in Baghdad. I have been working very hard to secure the airport, and it is a dangerous place. The company that runs the security is undermanned, and when you have people in your perimeter, it's almost impossible to secure. Plus, all the attitudes and perceptions of people seem to have. I feel it's not if a bomb will hit, but when. I am trying to persuade people we need to move the operation to our own facility. In what he talked about then was he was making a recommendation to moving the Halliburton operation into the controlled area controlled by the military. That would give them additional security. And they were meeting resistance at the time. However, I am meeting political resistance. I just want to save lives, American lives. And he put that into parentheses. Cost is terrible weapon. I love you guys. Give everyone a kiss, Ronnie.
And that's the letter he wrote to you December 27, 2004. Mm-hmm. Just about 2 weeks later, January 11th, he said, I'm doing pretty good. I'm involved with this airport more than my job title would suggest. Yesterday, Globe Security threatened to walk off the job if they weren't paid by 3 p.m. They had not been paid in 8 weeks. The Army was not ready to take over their position, so they finally settled on a handshake deal. The Iraq government was taking the money from the U.S. and not giving it to Global. The money is probably in a Swiss account somewhere. These people are the most corrupt bunch I've ever seen. Everyone is on the take. This is your son,
That's
Ron,
nice.
Writing to you January in 2005.
That's correct.
Do you think these emails had anything to do with his getting beaten up later?
I don't know the facts about whether he was beat up because of these emails, but I know that he was meeting a lot of resistance on the memorandum that he produced to Halliburton in regards to the security of the airport. He felt that that security of the airport was not secure. He felt that American lives were at stake and that he wanted to save those lives, and especially anybody that's in that airport. He wanted to make sure everything's fine.
I wanted to bring Prothop into this right now. Prothop Chatterjee, you've been to the airport. So you've got an area that is not secured by the military, but where the workers like Halliburton, like KBR workers work. Is this what Ron is referring to when he says that this area should also be, that he wanted to move the KBR operation to a military secured area?
Well, I'm not familiar with specifically where that particular group of people is. And you have to understand there are anywhere between 24,000 and 40,000 employees of Halliburton in Iraq. And many of the locations are different. There's a company, another company that was employed, and we talked about them actually about a month ago on Democracy Now, called Custer Battles, that's been charged with security at the airport. And, again, if the moment you step outside that airport, that highway to Baghdad is extremely dangerous. So the situation, differs based on specifically where you are and who you are. So, for example, we've gotten a lot of reports that the third country nationals, people from India, the Philippines, et cetera, are placed right at the perimeter because, their lives are more expendable. And so, and when mortars come into the camp, and mortars do come into both the airport as well as Camp Anaconda, incidentally, this is the same two locations that the truck drivers were driving from. They're driving from Camp Anaconda to the Baghdad International Airport. So there are certainly locations within each of these that are more vulnerable to attack even if it's highly secured. I mean, where I stayed in Baghdad, we'd see mortars land, you know, 100 yards away. And so unless they cover them with a glass dome, it's pretty much impossible. But what I'd like to actually say is there's a pattern here of A. Halliburton and other contractors not being in control of their employees. So who knows? Maybe the orders came on from above. I don't know that. But what we do know, and Mr. Chavez has been beaten. I know of at least one Halliburton employee, one Custer Battles employee, and one DynCorp employee who've been threatened that if they went to the press or blew the whistle, they would be beaten up or killed. And of course, and there are in fact three men who've been killed after they've talked about not working for Halliburton. I need to insist, two working for a company called Ultra Service who've disappeared or been killed after they've tried to blow the whistle. And so there's this climate of fear, and also the climate of managers doing whatever they want. And as I mentioned a little earlier in this show, in this other story, we have managers sitting, Halliburton managers sitting in Kuwait, taking million-dollar bribes. And in fact, one was indicted in Georgia 10 days ago for taking a million-dollar bribe. This is a senior guy from Halliburton who was signing contracts for fuel supply to a base in Kuwait, and he's not the only one being investigated. The senior managers on the take, or at least some of them are, they're turning a blind eye to what's happening below. They have no control of either the fraud or the threats that are being lobbed at their employees from within, from other fellow Americans, as well as from without. From the resistance in Iraq.
Prothap Chatterjee is joining us on the telephone from California. Eli Chavez is here with us. He lives in Albuquerque but has come to Houston, where his son lives, though Ron Chavez was in Iraq until he was severely beaten on Easter. We're going to break and then come back to our discussion. What's happened with the men who were involved in the beating of Ron Chavez. And as we are broadcasting this, Ron's wife is awaiting a call from Ron Chavez. She is hoping that he is landing now in Germany. He was in intensive care in Iraq. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we broadcast in over 330 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV 9410, Link TV, as well as DirecTV Channel 375. And we video and audio stream at democracynow.org. And our closed caption for people who are deaf or hard of hearing. 2 to 3 stations a week are picking us up. And if you want a radio or TV station in your area to pick Democracy Now! Up, just go to our website at democracynow.org. We're on our Unembed the Media tour. We're broadcasting today from Houston, Texas, where Pacifica station KPFT is, headed later today to Washington, D.C. to celebrate WPFW this evening. And then tomorrow, Los Angeles, KPFK. And on Friday, in San Francisco, we'll be celebrating KPFA. Then on to Portland, Oregon on Saturday and Saturday night. night in Seattle to celebrate KBCS, community radio. We are talking about a young man in Iraq working for Kellogg Brown and Root, a subsidiary of Halliburton. On Easter Sunday, he was severely beaten by other Americans, people he called the Redneck Mafia. Called to a site, not clear why, didn't go with anyone else, was severely beaten, was put in intensive care, and now we believe is being flown to Germany. We're talking with his father, Eli Chavez, who has come here from Albuquerque to Houston to talk about his son's case. This is where Ron Chavez actually lives with his wife, Patty. Patty is just outside our studio here waiting for a call from her husband, Ron, hoping that he has landed in Germany. There are a number of questions about this case. Was the beating racially motivated? Did it have to do with a memo that he wrote to his higher-ups at Kellogg Brown and Root, Halliburton, concerned about corruption, concerned about safety and security? Democracy Now! Sent an email to Kellogg Brown and Root, Halliburton, asking a series of questions. One, what is being done to the alleged perpetrators in the alleged beating of Mr. Chavez? Is a law enforcement agency involved? Is the U.S. military involved? Who is investigating this incident? Number two, have any of the alleged perpetrators left Iraq? If so, where did they go? Why were they allowed to leave? Have any of them been disciplined in any way by the company? Is KBR or Halliburton aware of the existence of a redneck mafia or a similar group at the Baghdad airport or affiliated in any way with either company? The response, as we previously stated, KBR is currently investigating the situation and cannot provide further details at this time. Eli Chavez, you are Ron's father, deeply concerned about what is happening to him. You want him out of Iraq, right?
I want him out of Iraq.
Why?
I'm afraid that he'll end up either thrown out of the perimeter of at the Baghdad airport, and the Iraqis capture him, or somebody might hurt him. As the gentleman on the phone said, there's been cases where people have been hurt afterwards. And I'm a former federal law enforcement officer. I was a DEA special agent, and I resent any beating, and I'm whatever it takes, I'm going to follow through with this.
You also worked for the CIA?
Yes, ma'am, I did.
When?
Back during the Vietnam War, I had command of guerrilla forces in Laos, a group of people, and I spent 2 years in combat there with them.
Mm-hmm. Were you afraid, Ron, going to Iraq, starting to talk to you about the problems he saw there, that something could happen to him?
Absolutely, I was. It seemed like it wasn't falling in place like a normal situation would in a combat area, mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that that he would be taking a lot of risks. But in war, there's a lot of risks, and we have to acknowledge that. But we also have to acknowledge the fact that Americans have to support Americans there. Or else, there's going to be chaos. Well, I do not like what they did to my son, and I don't think anybody seeing what's going on in this camera right here today likes it either. And I call upon all Americans to get involved in this case and call your senators and tell them exactly what's going on, because it's time that we do something about what's going on. And I'm more concerned about my son, because my son was brutally beaten by eight people, and there could have been more, and nobody broke it up, and that's what upsets me. I don't know who called for the medevac, and that was a very important thing. Whoever did that saved my son's life, and I am happy about that.
Now, what has happened with some of these workers? They've been just sent away?
What I understand, I haven't talked to anybody at Halliburton, and I understand that they sent three people away. But it seems to me like Halliburton should have been more responsible and filed a criminal complaint against them, rather than just send them home. There's there's more to this than what I believe we all know here. And I think that that the federal government should get involved so that does not happen to again to another American or any or Iraqi or anybody. This beating is not right.
Who has jurisdiction?
I believe the United States government has jurisdiction there because Halliburton's under contract with the United States government and the Pentagon, and any time that you have a contract with the U.S. government, and based on my experience, is that the U.S. government is responsible, and it goes all up to the top and anybody it, like in a vicarious liability case. Everybody's named within responsibility. So somebody has to grab the bull by the horn, and it seems like I hope they do soon.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We are certainly going to continue to cover this case. Again, we will let you know if by the end of this broadcast, Ron does call his wife, Patty, who is right here outside of the range of the microphones, waiting for the call to let her know that he has arrived in Germany.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you very much, Eli Chavez. Former federal employee, worked for the DEA, worked for the CIA, now his son, having suffered this brutal beating in Iraq, an employee of KBR, beaten, he says, by other employees of KBR. I want to also thank Prothap Chatterjee of CorpWatch.org. As we wrap up today's broadcast, on the death of one of the most well-known lawyers in this country, Johnny Cochran. He died of a brain tumor at his home in Los Angeles, 67 years old. He's perhaps best known for his work on the defense of O.J. Simpson during a murder trial in which Cochran uttered the famous quote, "If it doesn't fit, you must acquit." His family released a statement that said, quote, "Certainly Johnny's career will be noted as one marked by celebrity cases and clientele, but he and his family were most proud of the work he did on behalf of those in the community. As Johnny always said, an injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." It was his rallying cry as he worked to right many wrongs and as he provided a voice to those who needed to be heard. Johnny Cochran was deeply committed to helping and inspiring others, especially young people. His extraordinary law career will undoubtedly stand the test of time, but it was his devotion to his fellow human beings that it will remain his true legacy, they said. Over the years, Cochran represented football great Jim Brown on rape and assault charges, actor Todd Bridges on attempted murder charges, rapper Tupac Shakur on a weapons charge, and rapper Snoop Dogg on a murder charge. But the moment he called the happiest day of his life, practicing law, came in 97, when his client, the former Black Panther leader, Geronimo Jijaga Pratt, who spent 27 years in prison for a murder he didn't commit, was freed. We're joined now on the phone by a California attorney, Stuart Hanlon. He worked for 25 years with Johnny Cochran on the case of the Black Panther leader, Geronimo Jijaga Pratt. But now we're joined on the phone by Stuart Hanlon. We're hoping that he is with us. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Stuart Hanlon. Are you with us? Well, in this case, we'll go to the tape of October 5th, 2000, an interview that I did with Juan Gonzalez, who co-hosts Democracy Now!. In the studio with us was Geronimo Jijaga Pratt, Johnny Cochran, and the other attorney for Geronimo Jijaga, Stuart Hanlon.
Throughout our trial especially, and Mr. Pratt would always say, "They're out to get me," there, and I would always say, "Well, what do you mean by they? What do you mean by they? Who is this they?" And of course, he was right, and as I said, I learned a lot from representing Mr. Pratt, you know, that a little paranoia is healthy, that even paranoid people have real enemies, and of course, he was right, that it was they. It was the FBI. It was the counterintelligence program, and Amy, how we found this out was through the good offices, really, of Stuart Hanlon. In the intervening years after the conviction, through the Freedom of Information Act, we were able to find out a number of things. That this man, Julius Butler, who was the star witness for the prosecution, who got on the stand and said that Mr. Pratt confessed to him, and was asked by me, have you ever been an informant for the FBI or any other agency? And he said no. He said no, unequivocally no. He lied. At that point, he said that he'd informed 33 times. And in fact, he was an informant for the LAPD and the LA County DA's office. He was their confidential informant. They'd done that. They had wiretapped our phones. They had had informants in the defense environs, that meaning that somewhere in our offices they knew everything we're going to do. They had failed to give us Brady material, that is exculpatory material, where the husband of this lady who was shot had positively identified two other people. They kept that from us. They did all these things in an effort to neutralize, which meant kill, destroy, lock up forever, Geronimo Pratt at the behest of J. Edgar Hoover.
Of course, at that time, you were already developing a reputation in L.A. I think in the book it says that you told Geronimo, I've already won like 10 murder cases. I'm going to win this one as well. But you had no idea even then the depth of what the law enforcement officials, what extremes they'd resort to be able to get a person they wanted to get.
Juan, it was incomprehensible to me to believe they would go that far. I thought in a fair fight we would win. And we would have won in a fair fight, but it wasn't a fair fight. And I didn't realize the depth to which your own government could turn on a citizen, a decorated, authentic American hero, two tours in Vietnam, but yet because of the fact that he was a leader, a charismatic in his own right, bright, a tactician, they saw him as a threat, and they were willing to do whatever. And not only did they do this to convict him, but then they held him basically incommunicado for the first 8 years in solitary confinement. And then they still, even at the very end, when Stuart Hanlon and I argued this case to that judge in 1997, we had convinced everybody in the courtroom, we thought, that Pratt had gotten no trial. I turned to the DA, whom I'd known when I was a DA, and said, join us in asking to let this man out. They still wouldn't. In fact, even after they lost, they appealed it to the appellate court, and the court ruled unanimously against them. So the cover-up, the attempt to keep this man locked up continued to the very end. They didn't give us anything. And then we sued him after that.
Johnny Cochran speaking in the year 2000 as he sat in WBAI studios with Geronimo G. Jagger Pratt, who just came out with his book, Last Man Standing, and Stuart Hanlon as well, the other attorney in this case, who now joins us on the line. Stuart worked with Johnny Cochran for a quarter of a century on the Geronimo G. Jagger case. Welcome to Democracy Now, Stuart.
Hi.
It's good to have you with us. We're sorry to have such a brief amount of time, but in this last minute, can you share your thoughts about Johnny Cochran?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about him, and Geronimo and I were talking last night, and I think what a lot of us feel is that Johnny was most well known to the rest of the world about O.J. Simpson. It made him a superstar. But I think long before O.J. Simpson, Johnny made a career and a life fighting for people who were basically people of color who were brutalized by the police and other institutions. And I think he always felt his big victory, the most important thing, was representing Geronimo and getting him out of prison. And that's a part of Johnny Cochran that's realer than the O.J. Simpson lawyer. And it's a thought.
On that note, Stuart, we're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to continue to look at Johnny Cochran's life. And I want to thank you for being with us, Stuart Hanlon, Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Jeremy Scahill, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan here in Houston. Thanks for joining us.